yoga classes, voter registration, tools, cooking pans, and toys, and, of course, books. Libraries across Wisconsin look a little different from your grandmother's library. An effort to keep up with an increasingly digital society, libraries are evolving. Amid this transition are roadblocks, for some libraries find themselves facing financial challenges. Good morning, welcome to the West Side. Today we're talking about the state of Western Wisconsin's public libraries. I'm Claire Neipert. Joining us today are Shelley Tugis, director of the Hudson Area Public Library. Good morning, Shelley.
Good morning.
Also, we have Catherine Elkert, director of Rice Lake Public Library. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
And Amy Stormberg, director of Amory Public Library. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
As always, you're invited to join our conversation. You can do that by calling us at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. I want to start by getting into the history of our public libraries. The first library in Wisconsin opened the same year it became a territory, in 1836. It had 1,500 books. Late fines at this library were hefty. The state library catalog records a fine of 25 cents per day, which would be $10 in today's money. This library is still around today. It's known as the Wisconsin State Law Library. Our state's first public library opened in Black River Falls, near us, in 1872. A commission was established later that century to aid these free and public libraries. It was called the Wisconsin Free Library Commission. The commission trained librarians and created a system of traveling books. And according to the commission's 1900 annual report, quote, in library work, class, denominational, and social distinctions are forgotten or ignored, and many towns are getting most important lessons in united work. Today, Wisconsin is home to 332 public libraries. Let's dig into that term, public library. Catherine, what does it mean if a library is public?
Ugh, this is such an interesting question. So public means it's literally available and open for all. Unlike a lot of organizations, right, literally everybody that walks into the library has that right to be there for whatever reason, right? They could be starting a job hunt, they could be finding a cookbook, they could be needing some early literacy education classes. And like you outlined at the beginning of the show, the public library can provide all that and more. But really what we're looking at now in today's library is kind of the connector of the community. We're really interested in connecting our patrons, our people, to the greater resources, both in our small communities, but the larger world.
Catherine, when you think about it, and this is Shelley, libraries are essentially the last free public gathering space in our society. And that's pretty incredible. And I know some people might say, oh, well, a park. Well, actually, a lot of parks, you need a permit, you pay to get in, or they're for the exclusive use of a neighborhood. And in Wisconsin, we're not in our parks 52 weeks a year. So libraries are very special places.
Yeah, I think about that a lot as like the true gathering place of our communities.
As I mentioned, public libraries have been around for more than a century. Amy, how have you seen libraries change since you've been in this field?
Libraries change because we adapt to whatever the needs are for our community. When libraries first were in existence, it was about providing books. The majority of it was about providing books. Now we just provide so much more. We are a community hub, like we've been discussing. We serve people from all walks of life. We have digital materials now. We still have our books and brick and mortar and those kinds of things, but we're about so much more than that. We have so much more to offer. We have some libraries have hotspots. We have cake pans, like you mentioned, and library of things, we call it, where it's not just about books. So we really adapt to our communities and what our community needs are, and we try to offer whatever we can that's going to help the people that live where we work.
Let's go ahead.
Start with the children's department. I mean, I'm thinking back to when I was a kid and I would go to the library. It was super quiet and there were lots of frowny faces from the librarians, if you were talking or whatever. Well, it's not like that anymore. The children's departments, they hustle. There's a lot of energy. There is some noise. But part of that is, I think for libraries, if you are focused on literacy, the first step is helping kids fall in love with the library. And that whole concept of literacy has expanded for us too. When you come in, you will see kids looking at books and reading, but they're also putting together puzzles. They're playing with Legos, doing puppet shows, crafts. And all of those things are really kindergarten readiness skills. And so we're feeding the children the skills they need to be successful in kindergarten.
Let's talk more about how library usage has changed. After Amazon, Netflix, and similar platforms changed our media landscape, the Wisconsin Policy Forum reported that visits to libraries and circulation of traditional materials like books have decreased between the years of 2000 and 2018. But on the rise are library Wi-Fi usage, program participation, and circulation of electronic materials. Amy, what does that mean for your librarian, Amory?
We do have a lot of electronic materials that we serve, but just to go back a little bit, because of where we live, internet access isn't always available for the people of our community. So we do still see a lot of people checking out movies and checking out audiobooks and things like that because we don't have the access to the internet that a lot of other communities have because we're rural. So we do see usage in both.
What about you, Catherine? How have you seen electronic materials expand options for patrons?
Yeah, it's a whole new world, right? If you have a smartphone, you can literally carry a library in your pocket. So yes, perhaps physical circulation of library materials is different, but like you said, like people usage is up, right? People come to our programs, people are using our digital materials, and people are using those pocket libraries that they can carry around. Like 10 years ago, could you have ever imagined that you'd have millions of books in your pocket, all provided to you for free thanks to your public library? The only thing you need is a library card. But yeah, we definitely see the internet as an important spot for the library in terms of, offering it as a free resource for our patrons to come in and use our computers, but also kind of reaching out to our community. So we circulate those Wi-Fi hotspots. We circulate Chromebooks because, like I said, most of our patrons, if they have internet access in rural Wisconsin, it's usually on a smartphone. So that's really great for daily connections, but for certain things like applying for jobs, applying for unemployment, healthcare, you really need kind of a more substantial, a laptop. So I would expect that this kind of emergence on the focusing on the digital technologies will just continue to be really important, both for libraries and our patrons.
So now that librarians have to kind of know how to work with the tech and the Wi-Fi, Shelley, how have you seen university library science degree programs adapt to that continued change in technology?
Well, I am currently in a program getting my master's, and there's a lot of focus on what we actually talk about a lot is how to adapt, because this is the problem of technology. It's so expensive for library budgets. It quickly becomes obsolete and needs to be replaced, which again is another big price tag. And then there's training staff and how to use it so patrons can use it. So there's very expensive steps in technology and bringing it to people. So we focus more in our classwork talking about how do you collaborate with community organizations to provide that? How do you collaborate even with other libraries to provide it? And then have a few experts in a few areas instead of trying to learn how to do everything. For us, we have a 12-hour a week person who helps us with their IT. And then we'll do a little bit of programming. Like we have a 3D printer. And so he's shown people how to use that. So that is the big thing, is helping leaders understand how to manage the adaptation process and collaboration so libraries can actually fulfill this need, because it's never going to get there by the budget we need. So we're going to have to be very, very flexible and creative.
More on adaptations. When the pandemic hit, we saw many community institutions stay open, but they kind of changed the way they interacted with the public to coincide with public health guidelines. Amy, when the pandemic shutdowns began, what was your first priority as director?
Was to try to figure out how we can continue to serve the public. And I have to say, from a personal viewpoint, that I'm so proud of what libraries have done to adapt to that change. We started doing curbside service. We started lending our Zoom accounts to people so they could still have meetings. We started doing material bundles where someone could call the library and say, "Hey, I would like books on dinosaurs for my son," and we could bundle materials for them and they could come and pick them up outside of our doors. So we did everything we possibly could think of to continue to provide services to people in our community, even though our doors weren't open, quote unquote, to the public at that time. So libraries are very adaptive, they're very innovative, and we continue to look at resources that we have to continue to offer these things to the public.
I'm also impressed with how nimble we were, because this stuff happened quickly. And I know in 2 days here in Hudson, we had YouTube programming up and running within 2 days. And we now have 200 some videos out there. So we quickly, our programming had become just huge. It was a big emphasis of what we were doing here in Hudson. In 2019, we had 20,000 people come to library programs. And we just sat here going, we can't have these programs. We can't have what we used to, but people still want this kind of ongoing programming, some of it entertainment, some of it teaching. So we just switched. And I think that was one of the things that helped us stay visible, because it was easy for everything to sort of disappear in the pandemic. The services that you're used to getting, they were suddenly behind curtains, is how I would describe it. And so, for one thing, I wanted the public to see us. And so, having that YouTube channel reminded them that we are still there. We also did bin deliveries to senior living centers and to daycares, so they could get books. For the seniors, it's hard for them to get down to the library in the best of circumstances and icy roads and extra concerns over COVID. So that's how we handled that. We brought the books to them.
Catherine, what about you? What adaptations did Rice Lake Library make?
Well, just like my counterparts, we did all of those things, right? Curbside, transition to virtual programming, the bins dropped off. But we, similar to Shelley, we're big on programming, right? Really interested in breaking down those barriers of access to make sure people feel comfortable coming into the library. It's hard to be kind of thinking about a librarian as an authority figure if you've seen her dressed up as an inflatable dinosaur, right? So we found that our patrons were really missing that kind of part of the library. But how can you do a program if it's not safe to gather together? So we kind of broke our programs down and created what we're calling experience kits. So a library program in a box. And these range for all ages and all interests, from like musical kits, so like handbells for kids or ukuleles, to kind of more serious topics of like helping dementia caregivers with their charges, to snowshoes, where a person could come to the library, check those things out, have a library program, but in the safety of their own home. And we also, lots of libraries did this. I know Amory did. I think Hudson did too. We did make and takes. So like craft kits every week, where we prepare everything you needed, down to the paint and glue sticks sometimes. And patrons would come to the library and pick those up and then do those craft kits at home. So just kind of keeping people connected to the outside world in a safe way, but still engaged and having fun with their library.
And parents told us
Oh, yes.
craft kits, and we did some STEM kits as well.
Yep.
It kept them sane. It's
Yep.
like, you gave my kids something to
Something
do
to
for an
do.
hour. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and just, I mean, I think we're now that we're coming out of the pandemic, we're already forgetting like how isolating it was, how scary it was. And that's for grown-ups, right? So like having that established routine for our kiddos, we did those craft kits every week. So you know, we gave out, I think, more than 4,000 in 1 year.
It's
Just that routine
incredible.
for our kiddos, you know, is so important.
And I
And
would just like
what
to say, we also did the craft kits for the adults. So we had craft kits also so adults had something to do so they could de-stress and not have to think about everything that was going on in their lives. And they were also extremely popular.
And what of those adaptations will stick around at your library, Amy?
All of them. We hope to keep all of them in place. And so what we're looking at in the future is doing a hybrid version. So we'll still do programming and crafts and these things in person, but we'll also allow people the option to pick them up and take them home if the in-person doesn't work for them.
We're joined by Amy Stormberg of Amory Public Library, Shelley Tugas of Hudson Area Public Library, and Catherine Elkert of Rice Lake Public Library. We're checking in with our local libraries to learn about their challenges and the adaptations that they're making. Are you a regular library user? What kind of services do you want your local library to provide? You can call us at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Larry Mueller. Decks and outdoor living spaces have changed a lot in the last 20 years. Larry looks at those changes, including the use of steel framing for decks in other areas. That's Larry Mueller at 11. Next week on the West Side, we take a tour through western Wisconsin's night skies. Local astronomers will tell us how to best see the Milky Way, our neighboring planets, and meteor showers. That's next week on the West Side at 10 on this station. Today, we're joined by a handful of local librarians to talk about libraries in western Wisconsin here on the West Side. Amy Stormberg, I want to talk about your new space that you're moving into. Your library is transitioning into the city center. Can you give me a little bit of an update on that project?
Well, we're right in the throes of it right now. So we're hoping to be in by the end of December. Right now, they're in the middle of the construction, and we're kind of just getting weekly updates on what things look like inside. And we're just anxious to see what our space is going to look like, our final space.
How will that new space change things for your patrons, for people who visit the library?
I don't think there'll be a lot of changes for patrons. I mean, we're going to continue to offer the same services and do what we do. And if we get in and decide there's changes needed, we will adapt because that's what libraries do.
Let's talk about impact that libraries have on their communities. Shelley, the Hudson Area Public Library is a joint library, and that means it serves multiple municipalities. What role do you feel the library plays in these communities that it serves?
You know, that is a challenge, I think, for joint libraries in general, because we have one building, and the building is located in the city of Hudson. And so for people who are part of our library, but don't live in this community, sometimes the ownership, the sense of ownership and involvement can feel less. And so that's the main thing we are trying to work on right now is building stronger connections. And we are taking programs out of the building. So, for example, the Village of North Hudson, we did our Santa drive-through this winter. We took it to the park there. The mayor was phenomenal to work with. They were really excited to have us. And I've been telling our staff, the city of Hudson does not have the only parks in our area. We're going to go out to our other communities and do programs there and remind them that we're there for them too. So that has been a phenomenal transition that we have made. And it very much helps, you know, we have the ability to share books as a system. So those books on hold. And what we're looking to try to do is get locker systems in those communities so it's easier for them to get holds. It would be more convenient. You could get any time of the day and closer to their homes. They want to come to the library and get their holds. That's fine too. So those are two of the things that we're trying to do right now to serve the other partners who don't reside in the area where we are physically located. We're trying to not be just a physical location.
Catherine, at the top of Rice Lake Public Library's website are the words community, access, service, and public good. How do those words reflect your mission, vision, and service to the community?
So those are actually our organizational values. A couple of years ago, we came together as a community and really went through kind of a whole list of adjectives that could describe libraries. And overwhelming, like my library board, my library staff chose those words to kind of define who we are for ourselves. So frankly, I think about those words every day. Most of the time you'll find me wearing a t-shirt that have those words written on the back, actually. Because when I'm thinking about, you know, creating a new library program, coming up with a new collection, or like going out into the community, those are the things that I want to bring to the table. So they've really kind of blossomed into so much, kind of our core organizational values. And when you think about it, you know, what's more important to the public than their library being about providing service, access, the public good for our patrons, right? I mean, so we try and live those values every day.
Marquette Law School polls from 2015 and 2017 found differences in the way people used libraries based on their demographics. They found that Black respondents, lower income earners, rural residents, and people over the age of 60 were the most likely to visit a library to seek help from a librarian. And the numbers were similar when it came to library internet usage. When asked how a library closing would impact them personally, Black, older, and low-income residents said that it would have a major effect at rates higher than the statewide average. So, Amy, how do you see the Hudson Area Public Library interacting with underserved populations?
I'm with the Amory Public Library, so I don't know if that was a question for Shelley or...
Shelley, but you can answer it too. Shelley, go ahead.
You know, one of the issues we have here, I think the biggest issue, is transportation for access, getting people into the building, hours that people are working. And so we're trying to do more, bring service to them. And as an example, we work with United Way now. We're coming up with ways that we can collaborate and getting books to the food shelf. Maybe we could do a story time at the food shelf if we had hours we knew where lots of families tended to come. So access, we have all these great services, and if people can't get to them, then they're not great services, right? Great services are only great when they're used. So those are some of the key things that we're trying to do, is if people can't get to us, how can we get to them? And the expertise we provide when people get here, I think, is also really helpful. Digital literacy is a huge issue in any community right now. And so now part of our role as librarians is people come in, I need this kind of information, that kind of information, and help to steer them to credible sources and not junk. And also be careful what they're entering into computers. I had somebody, well, let's just say issues with her social security card and, you know, the cautionary tales we need to share. So that's a long way of saying that access is a major problem for some people, for some populations. And in a smaller community, we don't have public transportation. I'm sure Rice Lake and Amory don't have public transportation. So we have to be really creative and innovative to meet the needs of some of those people.
Okay, Amy, at Amory Public Library, how do you see your library serving underserved populations?
One of the things we do, and I think some of the other libraries do, is we do some outreach services. So like Shelley was saying and Catherine alluded to, we bring services to the people that can't necessarily come in and get our services. We do home delivery for homebound patrons. And, you know, if there's an entity that needs us, a school or a daycare, or someone that needs us to bring information to them, we try to find people that need information and bring it to them if they're not able to come to us for it.
Catherine, I'm wondering, where do libraries fit into our conversations about community resources like employment centers or domestic violence shelters? Where do they fit?
Yes. Oh, this is so interesting. This is one of the things that I think really libraries are kind of right on the edge right here, because particularly in our area of the state, a lot of smaller communities, there aren't the resources you have in big cities, right? Most of our communities don't have a domestic abuse shelter. They don't have homeless shelters. They don't have those kind of access points that people desperately need. So libraries, at least at my library, are really becoming that connector, right? So if someone walks in without a place to stay that night, my librarians are the ones calling, making those connections for those patrons. And I think that's something that a person wouldn't expect a public librarian to be doing, right? But that's part of our essential work, being that community connector, being aware of the resources and putting people in touch with the resources they need in a helpful and dignified way.
We're checking in with local librarians today on the West Side. You can call in to join our conversation. That number is 800-228-5615. Again, that's 800-228-5615. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. To wrap up our conversation about impact, lately we've been seeing in a lot of institutions in our state pushes for diversity and inclusivity. And so, Catherine, where are you seeing libraries fit into that conversation? What sort of conversations are you having?
Oh, this is so important. I mean, every day, this is an essential work. Like we've been talking about, if members of the public don't feel comfortable coming into the library, we've lost. So librarians need to and are working very hard to make our spaces as accessible and welcoming to our various groups as possible. So I know many of us have completed extensive homelessness training, de-escalation training, LGBTQ training, dementia, making sure our organizations are dementia friendly, just so we can kind of break down our own biases, acknowledge our own privileges, and really be a thoughtful curator of a community space. I think of this as essential work, Clara, because what is more important to the public library than being accessible and welcoming for everybody?
Shelley, where does Hudson Area Public Library fit in?
Well, you know, there's more diversity in some of our communities than people think. It's just sort of hidden. People don't always know that it's there. For example, homelessness or home insecurity is another way to describe it. Like, I'm not on the street, but I'm couch surfing. That's still homeless. One thing that we've done, Hudson is a real polarized community, and there have been a lot of sort of cracks in our community culture over the last couple of years. So the library has a series, it's called Voices in the Valley, where we have a panel of speakers from various groups who share what it's like to live in Hudson. For example, we had LGBTQ voices. We had voices of our neighbors with disabilities, Black voices, Asian voices, etc. And these were held in person. Most of it was virtual because we have been dealing with the pandemic. And I know one of those sessions alone has like 5,000 views. So there is a lot of interest in that. So we're trying to help the rest of the community see the people around them and understand and develop empathy for the different circumstances that we all live in. We become a big player in our community's Golden Rule Project. The mayor announced in Hudson that 2021 is the year of the Golden Rule. And the Voices in the Valley series, that's part of the Golden Rule. So that has been one of our big key things. We also hope to do a diversity audit of our children's section this upcoming year. There's a big push in publishing about diverse voices, and that means diverse authors, diverse illustrators, diverse characters in books, because everybody deserves to have books where they can see themselves in the story. And that has not been the case for a very long time. And it's something that libraries are working really hard on right now.
So we're talking about all these roles that libraries are filling. Amy, do you feel like libraries receive the amount of funding and support they need to fully carry out those roles?
I think funding is always a challenge for public libraries. We're always trying to make our dollars stretch, and librarians are fantastic examples of living on a shoestring budget and the things we can do with a limited budget. But regardless of that, we will always continue to strive to do the best that we can with the resources that we have available to us.
I'm getting a question from someone in our email from Terry in Roberts, Wisconsin. Just a question about ebooks. I've downloaded ebooks from Project Gutenberg, but never from my public library. How does that work? How do you download an ebook? Catherine, can you answer that question?
Oh, yes. It's so easy and fun. So hopefully Terry has a smartphone, or you can download an ebook using kind of any internet browser. But what you do is go to your app store, whether it's, you know, the Play Store, the App Store, whatever, and download the Libby app. So the woman's name. You have to have a library card, but I know that there's a beautiful public library in Roberts, Wisconsin that you can go visit, and they'll be happy to set you up. So you have a one-time kind of login situation, and then you're literally good to go. There's ebooks, so just a book on the screen, but then there's digital audiobooks, which is actually my favorite digital platform to listen to. So instead of having, you know, like the 26 CDs that are, you know, kind of bulky, you can have that 40-hour book on your phone. It's so slick. So that's all you need, just one library app.
Today, we're checking in with local librarians on the West Side. We're joined by Catherine Elkert of Rice Lake Public Library, Amy Stormberg of Amory Public Library, and Shelley Tugas of Hudson Area Public Library. How have you been impacted by your local library? Are you worried about keeping it funded? We want to hear your questions or comments. Call us at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Clara Neipert. This is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Every Thursday at 10 on this station, it's Spectrum West, where Al Ross brings you the best of Western Wisconsin art, culture, and humanities. That's Spectrum West at 10 on this station. Today, you're on the West Side, you're listening to the West Side, and we're talking about public libraries in Western Wisconsin. We were just talking briefly about funding, and I want to continue that conversation. Libraries are funded through taxpayer dollars, but the funding formula is much more complicated than that. Catherine, please give us a brief overview of what goes into that equation.
So you're right. Funding for public libraries is very complicated, and it gets even harder with joint libraries, so Shelley's going to talk about that later. But for most run-of-the-mill public libraries, say like the Rice Lake Public Library, we have two major funding sources. The bulk of our funding comes from our city, our municipal government, through general property taxes, and that pays for about 70% of my operational costs. The remaining 30 comes from surrounding and our home county through this really kind of wonderful and difficult to understand state statute that we refer to as Act 150. So the idea is, if you live in a community, a city with a library, say you live in the city of Rice Lake, you pay for your public library through your general property taxes. But say you live in a township, the township of Rice Lake Or, for example, I live in the township of Cedar Lake that doesn't actually have a library. You're not paying those general property taxes, right? So you are paying for your library through your home county. That Act 150 money comes for libraries as reimbursement from their county. So anybody that lives outside of a community with a direct library, the people in the townships, for example, their counties pay for their usage of their public library, because counties have decided and the state of Wisconsin has decided that public library access is so important. We need to guarantee that access for all of our citizens. So when I go to the library as a township resident for the Rice Lake Public Library, anytime I check out a material, my county, Barron County, reimbursed the city of Rice Lake 70% for the cost of that CERC. Now, sometimes we wish it was 100%, but 70%, that reimbursement of 70% is better than nothing. And the public library is actually really unique in that fact, because other city departments, say like the streets, don't get any money for people outside the city driving on city streets. But the library receives a certain amount of funding, 70% of the cost of each CERC, as kind of a reimbursement payment for the use of the library services.
I want to turn now to a listener question. Vern from Boyd wonders how many rural areas of Wisconsin libraries have closed or are understocked? Again, how many rural Wisconsin libraries have closed or understocked? He's saying that happen a lot. So he's wondering, why don't rural communities seem to value funding libraries anymore? Amy, I'm going to give that question to you as director of Amory Public Library.
I don't personally know of any libraries that have closed their doors. So I'm not quite sure how to answer that question, because I don't know of any libraries that have actually closed their doors. But I think that most members of the community value their libraries. And I think as far as the funders, how they value their libraries, I believe most of them do value their libraries, and that, you know, it might be a community to community issue more than it is a general issue. But I personally don't know any libraries that have closed.
Yeah, I think maybe you are talking to three librarians that have faced significant financial difficulties over the past, say, 10 years.
Yes.
Speaking from personal experience at the Rice Lake Public Library, we've been cut three times in the past 8 years. So while we haven't had to close, we definitely had to make kind of impossible decisions, right? We've had to cut staff, we've had to cut operations, we've had to cut library hours. But our priority is, of course, to always try and keep our collection and our services as accessible as possible, even when we aren't being funded at the level that we sometimes need to be.
Another listener question. This is Catherine from Hudson. And they asked to Shelley, please explain the funding challenges that Hudson faces and how can these be better met? This is exactly where I wanted to go next. So Shelley, what's happening in Hudson?
Well, since we're a joint library, we have a unique set of circumstances. And basically, all the libraries in municipality, they have to be funded at a certain level by the municipality. And if the municipality doesn't do that, then the county will come in and tax municipal taxpayers. So pretty much every municipality is going to hit that minimum level. What happened in Hudson is we formed a joint library in 2003, and in 2012 found out our communities were not meeting that level. And 2012, those communities, our four communities, were supposed to pay the library $415,000. That's how far behind they were the minimum funding requirement. Now, You got to understand, 2012, levy limits had just passed, state aid had been cut. We were just sort of coming out of rough economic times, and our communities were, you know, strapped. How would we possibly come up with $415,000? And the answer was they didn't. They never paid it. We had about $600,000 in municipal funding at that time, and that $415,000 would have put us over $1 million. That was 10 years ago. And to this day, our municipal funding is at about $749,000. So it has been an incredible setback. And the legislature stepped in because our communities were not certain how they would ever catch up. And the legislative fix was to say, okay, joint libraries, you don't have to do what all the other libraries do. You don't have to worry about meeting that minimum funding level. You don't have to pay it back. And moving forward, the only thing we're going to ask you to do is to have a maintenance of effort, meaning you can't pay any less than the average of the prior 3 years. So that's where we've hovered. And it's really a disincentive to increase funding to your library because you commit yourself to higher funding levels in the future if you give an increase. So we've never recovered. And we are now in the position, we're going to close our doors 2 or 3 days a week, depending on what happens. And there's a variety of scenarios, but even if we didn't spend a dime more, and I mean, health insurance doesn't go up, we don't give our staff a penny raise, we don't buy more books, in 2024, 2 to 3 days a week, we will close.
Is there a chance that you could somehow revert back from the joint library structure?
We could, you know. I'll just say that all options are on the table. People realize we have hit a wall and the library is bleeding out. And local leaders are involved. They're working hard to find a solution. Every option on the table. One of those options is disbanding the joint library. But then all four communities would fall back to that county minimum. And they would have to come up with significant dollars. And it would either then go to the county or it would come to, in the case of the Hudson taxpayers, it would then come to the city of Hudson for the library. Mm. So a lot of them are talking about we need to preserve the joint structure. And if that means giving a very significant increase, because they've been saving hundreds of thousands of dollars of tax money over the years of this joint library. Right now, several of them are talking about a potential 30% increase. And while that sounds huge, I mean, that is huge. We are so far behind that that's like a half blown up life preserver. So it's staggering. And people in the community who are starting to hear the story, you know, their jaws drop. They didn't understand how this could have gone on for so long.
Out of all that, what is the best case scenario for you? What do you hope happens?
You know, the best case scenario will probably be a very novel approach. It might involve multiple levels of government, from the state to the county to the municipalities, to see what we can do for joint libraries to rectify that very destructive change in law. And it had a short-term good purpose. You know, it's more important right now to find a fix than to find fault. And that's where everybody is focused on. So I think we're going to need to be looking at all levels of government and continuing to engage the public because they're starting to get it and they're starting to talk to their local leaders about what's happened here and what needs to change and what they value about the library.
I want to turn to the future now for all of our guests. Catherine, in a perfect world, what do you see happening for your library?
That everybody kind of realizes what an amazing resource the public library is. We're basically the bedrock of democracy. So they come back to their library if they haven't been, get a card, and just kind of start exploring the collection. Share the news with their neighbors and friends, and really just share the word about what an amazing resource it is for everybody, right? Not just the little ones or the ones who come in to read the newspaper, but that we really have something to offer, something incredible to offer for everyone.
Amy, what are you excited about looking forward as director?
I would just like to piggyback a little bit on what Catherine said and said, I hope the community comes to us continually, and they're very good at it now, and voice their vision for the library. They let us know what they want from their public library, because libraries are experts at adapting to change and providing the resources that their community needs. So that's what I look forward to, is that continued interaction with the community where they let us know what they need and we do our best to provide it for them.
And Shelley, in your whole, the challenges that Hudson Area Public Library is facing, I'm wondering, what can a concerned community member do to help? What is there left to do?
Well, I think in terms of like our unique situation and our funding crisis is to let local leaders know that they value the library, they support a big fix. That's really important. That would be really helpful. It's helpful for local leaders, too, because they are trying to reflect public will. And if they don't hear from the public, it's hard for them to do that. We also have two phenomenal support organizations who have just, they're the reason we can do any programming at all. The Hudson Area Library Foundation and the Friends of the Library. And so if you're so inclined to make donations, the Hudson Area Library Foundation, we have no tax dollars for programs. Everything we do, from our summer reading program to the classes we do, bringing in a magician, having an art class for kids, having an author visit, that is all paid for by donations from community members, either to the foundation or they go to the Friends of the Library's book sales. And we're supported from the Friends in that way. So those are also very helpful. But using your voice right now is probably the most important thing you could do for our library.
You all three are library directors. I'm wondering, where do you see the future of your role specifically, a library director, going? Do you see younger generations interested in this career path? Let's start with you, Catherine.
Well, that's a really funny question, because library directors, at least in our state, tend to burn out pretty quick. So we do need new voices and new perspectives. Library school has never been more accessible. You can do it completely online. There's technical programs out there. So yes, if you are interested in making a difference in your community, loving what you do, but also facing some kind of pretty interesting challenges, library directorship is the way to go.
Amy, you started off in the business world, right? And you kind of transitioned into libraries. What's your take on that? What do you say to people who are thinking about getting involved in libraries?
Libraries are a very passion-driven industry. And for me, this has always been a passion for me. And like you said, this is a second career for me. And I love it. Libraries are just, I'm so passionate about it. And I don't think it matters what age you are. You can get into it at any age. You can get into it out of high school if you so choose to go to college for it. You can do it in the middle of your lifetime. I think it's just something you have to be passionate about. And it's just a very rewarding career.
It's been a wonderful hour talking about libraries in Western Wisconsin. Thank you so much to our guests, Shelley Tugas, Director of Hudson Area Public Library, Catherine Elkert, Director of Rice Lake Public Library, and Amy Stormberg, Director of Amory Public Library. Rick Ryer helped produce today's program. Kate Spranger is our on-air producer. She also manages publicity. Next week on the West Side, we take a tour through western Wisconsin's night skies. Local astronomers will tell us how to best see the Milky Way, our neighboring planets, and meteor showers. We'll be joined by UW-Eau Claire professor Dr. Nathan Miller and astronomer Mike Brown. It all happens next Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. I'm Claire Neipert, and this is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.